Woohoo!
Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
Happy Tuesday?
It's Tuesday.
Okay, it might actually be one of the best Tuesdays of our entire life. David, do you agree?
Oh my god, yeah, this totally beats marriage. This totally beats Leo being born. This eclipses it all because we got to interview Alex Honnold, one of our ultimate heroes in sport and life.
It was one of the most fun conversations. And yeah. I don't know, sometimes I've met heroes and I felt let down before. And Definitely. This was the exact opposite experience, even from the outset of our communication. So emailing him initially, Alex Honnold was responding with exclamation points. He was bringing that exclamation point game fire. And it just made us feel at ease the entire time.
Yeah. Could you imagine getting an email from Barack Obama with exclamation points? Because that's what it felt like to me to get those in our inboxes. So this conversation touches on everything. We start with his foray into ultra running and running recently. He's done outstandingly at some 50Ks. He's done an epic traverse outside of his home in Las Vegas. Then it gets into climbing. It talks about how the training approaches mix and where the interplays might be. Then we also talk about deep topics like death and fatherhood and aging as an athlete. And then we finish off with some really random things that were quite fun.
Well, we recorded an hour and yeah. We were expecting that to be kind of the conclusion of the podcast. And he came with a list of questions. He has gone through and listened to our podcast and yeah. He came with annotated notes. We were getting into the deep dives of mitochondria and it was so much fun.
How did it make you feel when you found out that Alex Honnold is a SWAT podcast listener?
I was very honored. And yeah. I thought about all the number of times we have made jokes on here about mitochondria, about freak flags, about any number of topics. I'm like, he's listened.
Yeah. He had a really good time with our comment about letting your freak flags fly, which appears on a lot of podcast episodes. He gave us a good hard time about that. But you know, that really shines in this interview. He's incredibly funny alongside with being just very curious. I mean, who comes to a podcast with questions for the people that host the podcast? And it just shows so much about him as a human, as does all of his other endeavors in life. The main one we want to highlight today is the Honnold Foundation. If you can, please go to that website right now. You can pause the podcast and donate there for equitable solar access. They're doing amazing environmental work. It goes right to communities and show them that SWAT podcast love. You can put SWAP in the address bar there to just let them know where you heard. Everyone listening, do that if you can.
It makes me excited to think about the fact that Alex Honnold, who has this like exclamation point joy in life, is giving back to the communities in this way. Yeah. And it's something that is so meaningful. So your support would mean a ton to that.
Definitely. And then also follow and subscribe to his podcast, which is Climbing Gold. Even if you're not into climbing, it's really good. As you'll see on this podcast, he's incredibly funny, but also brilliant. And those two combine to create the type of perfect podcast to listen to when you're running. And you might not want to hear only about running. You also want to hear about other things.
He also talks on 1.5 speed, very similar to how we talk. And at first, I mean, we've never interviewed someone who talks that fast. And it took me a second to get used to it, in all honesty. It was like rapid fire ping pong, but it was so much fun.
It was such a good game of ping pong. And I think our reflexes were outstanding because of Athletic Greens, which Alex's podcast is also sponsored by. Okay, if we take it, who cares? If Alex takes it, you know Athletic Greens works. So athleticgreens.com/swap, SWAP. If you use it there, you get bonuses. And we totally recommend it. He does too. He says he's been using it for a while. It's helped him feel better. So it's grade A shit.
I wish we had the chance to talk about it with him. We actually didn't get into Athletic Greens on the podcast, but we've talked about Athletic Greens and just the word potency. If you're a podcast listener, you know what that means. And we should have grilled Alex Honnold on that.
Yeah, well, we did get into morning erections on this episode. So if you stick around to the end, you'll hear Alex Honnold talk about erections, which checks off most of the boxes in my top 10 fantasies, which is pretty wonderful.
My life is now complete.
Also, if you're new to the podcast, please click follow wherever you get podcasts. It's huge for us. Give it a 5-star rating if you can. This is a labor of love. We're currently recording this quite late at night after the baby has gone to bed. And if you do that, it'll get it out to more people.
Thank you all so much. And now, without further ado, it's the Alex Honnold interview.
Alex Honnold, it's so good to have you on the Some Work All Play podcast.
Seriously, we are so pumped about this. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, no, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Yeah, you've been on our radar forever, obviously, as one of the best athletes in human history. But we had the courage, finally, to reach out to you after you did the Red Rock Canyon 50K recently. Fifth place. Absolutely crushed it. And maybe most importantly, as we were researching before this podcast, saw a picture of you shirtless that was stunning. So it basically had everything for the Summer Call Play podcast. Sexy man shirtless plus a great race result.
David, you saw that shirtless picture and you looked actually daunted, overwhelmed. It was not an excited reaction. You're like, oh, he just looks so good.
Some people have it all.
How are you feeling after the race?
Oh no, I'm good. I was very sore for a week afterward. But I think I got sixth because I think it was fifth for men because this one woman smoked the race. She went really, really fast. But also, yeah, it's a super uncompetitive race. There was no, I mean, no offense to anybody who ran, but I don't think there was any elite. You know, it's like a down home, like casual race.
Well, it's stunning how fast you went, just given that, you know, you focus
on climbing. I don't know how to run. Yeah,
I mean, that's the main place you want to start, is on the running journey. Like, how long have you been running for training, and what made you hop into the race?
I would say I've never run for training. I've run a little bit, and so we had a daughter 9 months ago, and congratulations to you guys since you have a new kid. I started running a little more once we had our daughter, just because it was a nice way to get out and get some exercise and like see fresh air for brief amounts of time and feel like I got some exercise. And I don't even know if this is totally true now, but do you know the alpinist Conrad Anker?
Yeah, definitely. You
know, so a long time ago, I remember Conrad saying that that when he had kids, he tried to run an ultra every year and climb El Cap every year as a way to just kind of like maintain a base, you know, just like a general all around fitness. And I don't know if that's true or not. I can't remember if he actually said that, but I've remembered it for years. And so it kind of stuck with me, where I was like, oh, if I have a kid, I need to run an ultra every year that I have a kid. And you know, obviously I climb El Cap too, but so I signed up for an ultra because the Red Rock 50K is close to home. It's, you know, places that I recreate pretty much year round anyway. So I was like, oh, it's a perfect race to run.
So before your kid was born, how often would you run, just in the context of like your normal life?
Before my kid, like never. I mean, I have no running background. No, that's not fair. I ran a 50K 10 or 12 years ago or something, basically off the couch. I used to occasionally jog on my rest days. So every, you know, I normally would climb two on, one off. So on my off days, I would go jog for, say, an hour or less. But that's always sort of like, because I was in some scenic place, you know, you're sport climbing in Spain. So on your rest day, you go like check out some ruins nearby or something. You know, it's not like running for training. It's just kind of like moving on your rest days because you're bored. and then I have a huge hiking base, you know, like I've done a lot of hiking and scrambling and just sort of adventure walking around the mountains, but definitely no running base at all.
What was it like building into the running base? Because I mean, I'm coming back postpartum. I did my first run on Wednesday and I could barely walk for 4 days after that. did you have a similar soreness experience as you started building into running?
Yeah, I would say that's the biggest problem for me as a runner. It's just that I just don't have any legs for it. Like every time I run, I'm like, oh, my legs kind of hurt. Or if I run far, I'm like, oh, my legs really hurt. It's like, I'm just not a runner.
So I've been going at it now for many years and I still feel the same way many days. I'm like, maybe I'm just not a runner. My legs hurt. So as you were approaching the 50K, and I mean, not just the 50K, that was incredible, but then also Honnold's ultimate Red Rock Traverse is one of the more stunning athletic achievements of the year, we think. What did your running training, how did it evolve in what it looked like in the build up to these things?
So for the build up to I ran the 50K, let's see, basically 1 month after I did the Hurt, the big traverse in Red Rock. And so most of my, you know, quote unquote running training was practicing the segments for the Hurt. So to do this big traverse of Red Rock, which was, I mean, it's basically the entire mountain range. But so I do the segments. And so in general, I would try to jog the flats to get to the mountain, and then I would climb a climbing route and sort of scramble over the summit, down climb the other side of the mountain, and then kind of jog back to the car. And so I was basically just jogging the commute distances, just, you know, to minimize my time away from home and to make sure I'd be, you know, home for dinner, that kind of thing. And so, but that kind of adds up, you know, it's like, say it's a couple miles each way each time. So every time you're going out, you're jogging like 4 or 5 miles, which for me is, you know, it's enough mileage that I'm like, I'm running. I ran 4 miles today, because the thing is the whole rest of the time I am on my feet and I'm moving briskly. So it's like quick jogging and, or not quick jogging, like quick scrambling, you know, like trotting up and down mountains. So, you know, for me, that's about as much cardio or running as I ever do. And then once I did the Hurt, then I had a month, but I went to Yosemite and then I was like climbing, you know, big walls, and I did 2 or 3 runs on flats just around the valley floor. I did 1 20-mile loop on flats that I was like, this is my attempt at like getting some running mileage. And then, and then did the actual 50, and I felt, you know, I mean, I felt fine. And I wasn't injured, but I didn't feel great. You know, it's like, like Yeah, I was joking that at the end, like if I had been forced to sprint to the finish line, like I would have died, I think. You know, I was probably running like a 9:30 mile to the finish line being like, I'm doing it. I'm going so fast. You know, and I was like, this is so embarrassingly slow. It's pretty grim.
There's a runner in the 1970s who is like, after track workouts, you should finish. And if someone put a gun to your head and say, do one more, you would say, shoot me. And that sounds like where you got to in the 50K. But for our listeners, actually, that don't know for context, Hurt, I mean, the exact details on it are probably difficult to track, as Alex described in his podcast, which we'll be promoting before this one. But 35 to 40 miles with like 25,000-ish feet of climbing, it's probably impossible to get to exactly. Absolutely bonkers. So it's, you know, a ton of training independent of just the running stimulus we're talking about.
In our household, we have this game that we play. It's what could Alex do? And we just combine these really bonkers routes that I don't think any human could do besides you. And it's often things that it's like, I don't know, I think only a helicopter could do that. But it's really fun to think about like the different types of routes that you could do.
I wish I would. No, I think all the stuff I'm doing is pretty mellow. I mean, the Hurt, the big traverse, it's like basically easy climbing with, I mean, the whole time I did it, I was like, man, somebody like Killian, if he knew how to climb, could do this so much better. You know, like if he knew how to climb at that level, because it's just because he does know how to climb. But, you know, because I mean, like 35 miles and 23,000 feet of vert or 25,000 feet of vert, whatever it wound up being. I mean, those are kind of similar numbers to some 100 milers, I think. You know, and similar amounts of time. Like, I don't know. I didn't feel, actually some of the rock climbing, I felt pretty fast, but overall the travel through the mountains, I didn't feel that fast. But the challenge for that kind of stuff is that I think if I wanted to feel fast doing it, I have to practice that way more often. Mm-hmm. And then there's a weird side to it where it's like, obviously it's slightly dangerous. Like you don't want to do that all the time because you'd eventually just die while practicing. And then also the more you practice it, the worse you get at every other aspect of rock climbing. You know, like the more time you spend scrambling 5.8, 5.9 as fast as you can, the worse you get. Like you're basically eroding your capacity to do that kind of climbing. You know what I mean? Like the more time you spend doing it, the worse you get at rock climbing. Like you lose power, you lose strength. And so then all of a sudden you're like, oh, now soloing 5.9 in my tennies actually feels kind of hard and scary because I'm just not as strong as I used to be.
Have you found that running in general, like the endurance component of running, has impacted your climbing ability at all? So I was a field hockey player in college and found long distance running around the time I started really becoming competitive. And I definitely felt like it impacted my pop. Do you feel that way with endurance impacting climbing strength at all?
Yeah, for sure. The few times that I've tried to go climbing after I run, you're just a horrible, horrible climber. Like running, I mean, is probably the worst thing you can do for your climbing. If you only run on your rest days and only small amounts, I mean, I think even like elite performance rock climbers, like, you know, World Cup climbers and people in the Olympics stuff, I think a lot of them do jog on their rest days a little bit, like do some mileage just to move their legs and like maintain a healthy heart and everything. But I think if you run any distance, it just makes you so bad at rock climbing.
Yeah, I totally identify with that too, because Megan was field hockey. I played football in college when I was a bigger guy. And I remember the first time I tried to run and I got maybe 200 meters and was sore for 3 or 4 days, much like Megan described postpartum. And, you know, seeing what you do climbing just from a distance, it really is a power thing, but it also has an endurance component that things like football don't, maybe field hockey does to a certain extent. Do you find that on the flip side, having this running tool in your back pocket might help with some of the longer, harder climbs you do, especially at the end? Because like, you know, some of the things you do, like the thing that Nat Geo did in the show, the Jimmy Chin show, those are long days and long times. Like, do you feel like the running helps in that end when you get farther along in these very big, you know, many hour events?
Well, that's the challenging thing when we talk about climbing. It's like climbing is such a broad sport. I mean, if we were talking about World Cup bouldering, then running wouldn't help in any way, except for maybe just kind of like general health. But when we talk about climbing as including mountain climbing and mountaineering and, you know, speed soloing and things like that, like doing speed records, then it's like, yeah, running might help in some of that. And then you have people like Uli Steck, if you know the famous Swiss alpinist, who's now deceased. But as somebody like Uli is a good example of taking his climbing and speed climbing to a whole different level through running training. And so, you know, depending on the type of climbing that you're trying to do, you know, running could have a place in it. But it's just... I think that, you know, it's like the right kind of seasoning. You just have to sprinkle it in at the right time of year for the right kinds of goals.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that has a very limited capacity for seasoning. So if climbing was seasoning, I would be like, too much. Very scary for me.
We have a limited capacity for seasoning, but in cooking, you just put seasoning over everything. It's really epic.
Yeah, my goal is for you to wake up at midnight being like, that was too much garlic powder, David. Because then I know you respect me and my spice ability. So let's go back to the 50K, because I think it's very cool to see, you know, this athlete that everyone, you know, loves and admires. You said you were sore for a week after. Is that was that a real statement? You were sore for a week after the 50K?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I didn't run again for a week, but I actually drove to Yosemite that night to go work on a project with a friend. And so we were climbing stuff. And then actually, I'd have to look at my calendar to remember the exact timing, but basically I wound up having COVID. So I was kind of sick when I ran the race, but like with a cold, our daughters like had all kinds of like little colds. And so we've had the sniffles nonstop. So I had the sniffles running the race, but it didn't seem to like, I felt fine, even though I was blowing my nose like nonstop for the whole race. But then that cold sort of just seamlessly transitioned into COVID. Like I think it masked the onset of getting COVID the next week. And then, I don't know. So then I was in Yosemite with COVID trying to climb big walls and, you know, unbeknownst to me. And so I think that all sort of conspired to make me feel not great. You know what I mean? Like I had one rest day where I was like, I'm going to go for a jog. And I was like, I can't go for a jog. But now in retrospect, it's like, well, I had COVID. I felt kind of worked. I just, you know, I was like, I was tired.
Yeah.
Well, I can't imagine racing a 50K in the context of, you know, having a cold and all of this, but how do you feel the lows of ultra running and racing compared to the lows of climbing? Do you feel like there's similar parallels there at all in terms of the mental space that you get into?
Yeah, I mean, I'd just say it's similar. Overall, running the 50K was so chill compared to doing the hurt or like a lot of the climbs. I mean, you know, it's like every hour there's somebody giving you free snacks with water. There are like people all around you. Nothing about it's dangerous. There's no chance you're going to get hurt. You could just stop anytime you want. You're in cell service the whole time. There's like a road nearby. Like everything about it is so chill. Like, compared to climbing outings when you're just by yourself in the mountains and if it goes sideways, you're going to die. You're kind of like, it's like, oh, running an ultra. Like I kept meeting all these nice people and I'd run with somebody interesting for like 20, 30 minutes. And then, you know, either they'd pull away or I would. And then you'd meet the next person and be like, oh, now this is some other friendly person I chat with for an hour. You know, it's like, I was like, this is all pretty relaxing, like pretty fun. You know, everything about it was much more type one. I mean, I'd say the last 10 miles, my legs didn't feel great. So I was like, oh, it's starting to be a bit of a grind. But compared to being 32 hours into a mountain traverse and trying to free solo, you know, I was like, this is all so chill.
Part of me was like, I hope he says that 50K was a lot like El Capitan. I bet it was the same thing, right? I bet it's totally similar.
Were you excited going into it? I mean, I feel like in climbing, you're kind of the excellence of sport. And I feel like, you know, you're stepping into trail running, which is something that's totally new to you. Was that refreshing in any sort of way?
Well, it's fun to participate in a sport where there are no expectations, no, you know, but it's always fun to be a beginner because you learn quickly, you improve quickly. You know, there's no, I don't know. I mean, I was running 50K just to finish, you know, and then I like finished pretty well. And I was like, wow, I exceeded expectations. You know, I'm pleased with myself. You know, it's like with climbing, it's rare and it's challenging for me to exceed my own expectations at this point. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it happens sometimes and you have moments where you're like, wow, I'm so impressed that I managed to do that thing. And, you know, I'm excited about it. But in general, I have very high standards for myself and I very rarely meet them. You know, you're sort of like, oh, you're just constantly failing basically. Whereas with running, I was like, holy shit, I did the thing I wanted to do. That's all it takes. You know, it's like, I didn't have any time goal or any, yeah, I just wanted to finish the race, be like, I ran an ultra. I'm like, great. It's a very low bar.
How entrenched were you in the ultra community before you ran this? Like, I guess if we did the Jim Walmsley and Courtney DeWalter test, do you know who those people are or how you've been following trail running?
Yeah, more than most climbers probably. I mean, I do know both of their names. I don't know which races they've won really. But you know, I mean, I know a fair amount, like I've done events with Killian because he kind of crosses over into the broader world of sport. And then, you know, people like Uli, I've, you know, talked to him about running training, not that he's an ultra runner, but I'd say that I know, I dated a woman who was a pretty serious runner for many years before my current wife. And so I supported her on a few 50 milers and things like that. And so, you know, at least I've been exposed to the ultra running scene a bit.
Yeah. It sounds a lot like us in climbing in the sense that we're huge climbing fans in the same way that you'd be fans of Steph Curry and the Golden State Warriors. Like,
totally.
You know, that we love it. We respect it, but also it's not necessarily our world, but it's kind of cool because like with the 50K, you're essentially able to go shoot hoops with Steph Curry for you. And you know, with that, with stepping into this totally new sport, was there any vulnerability in it? In that, like, all these people like us fans are just like, Alex fucking Honnold. And you step up to a start line. Is any part of you just like, oh, I just want to be anonymous and be able to do this and not have to think about anyone else talking about it afterward?
Yeah, I mean, I'd prefer to be anonymous, but honestly, it's better to be not be anonymous at a running race like that where there are no expectations. I mean, it's worse to go into the climbing gym where everybody expects you to have like a record-setting performance when you go to the gym. But I'm like, I hardly ever climb in the gym and I basically suck, you know? So, or I mean, that's not fair. Like, obviously, I'm better than average in a climbing gym, but it's like, but I'm not gonna shatter their expectations, you know? I'm just gonna have a little session. And you just never know because people see you in the gym and it's like the only time they ever see you, so they're gonna expect greatness. But you're like, this could be your second session of the day, 6 days in a row, or whatever. You know, it could be like a recovery session, it could be anything, or you could just be with your family like looking to hang out, and they're like, are you gonna do the hardest problem? And you're like, no. Like, no, I'm just gonna like move a little bit and stretch my shoulders, you know? It's like, so yeah. I mean, I think that those expectations are worse when you're within your own sport.
Now I'm imagining you going to the climbing gym and being forced to take the belay test and failing, just like you're, you just know, not
that has happened. And I mean, just just last week, I was at a climbing gym in Omaha, Nebraska. I was doing like a corporate speaking thing in Omaha, and went into the gym. I went from the airport straight to the gym because I was like, oh, I may as well stretch and like move a bit before I do an event in the evening. And literally every single person I met there was like, oh my God, what are you doing in Omaha? They're so, it's like, I took a picture with every single person in the entire gym, I think. But it was lovely. I mean, it was a nice time. But it certainly had that kind of a vibe where everyone is like, are you going to try the hardest problem right now and just do it? And you're like, no, I mean, I don't know. I just got off a plane. I'm just trying to like move my fingers a little bit. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, it's like a nice session, but that's where expectations start to be, you know, more, you just have to do your own thing, lead your own life, like not let it bother you.
Yeah. I mean, that's easier said than done, I imagine, especially in the idea of celebrity. One, you've transcended sport. But even within sport, within these small sub-communities, there can be, you know, aspects of celebrity. There's one moment each year where we go to Western States, for example, this 100-miler, and
I do know Western States. I mean, come on.
Yeah. That'd be like, there's this place called Yosemite that exists and is on the earth. But it's the one place where we go, and in this little village, everyone knows who we are. And after the week, as much as I love it on a certain extent because the people are amazing, much like you describe in Omaha, I kind of want to go curl up into a ball and hide for the rest of my life. Does that problem of celebrity, is that something that you just come to terms with over time, or is it something you still might push back against at times?
No, I think that's something you get used to. And especially, I mean, it is a choice. Like, you've chosen that path. And, you know, when people ask me, I'm always like, well, it's better than having a job. You know, it's like, at least I'm not. Technically, like, I mean, you guys are both highly educated. You would have really nice jobs. Like, I never finished university. You know, I'd be like hammering nails somewhere doing, like, who knows what I'd be doing. But technically, I have no skills and no, you know, it's like, I'd much rather have that level of problem than, you know, have a hard time supporting myself because I'm laying brick or something.
Well, if they use you to hammer nails and not climb the side of the building to get something at the top, we got a problem in the construction industry. It's a big deal.
That's a big problem. One question for you. So as you've gotten into the ultras, are you craving more? Did you finish?
No. No, actually, a bunch of my friends were like, so you're going to run a 50 miler next? I was like, no, that's a hard no. I mean, I am kind of into the idea of running one ultra a year, like maintaining some kind of running base. And actually, I wrote down a few questions I have for you guys because I was like, oh, I'm going to talk to some coaches. I've got some things I want to learn. But but we can get to that whenever. But basically, I think to run more than a 50K requires just too much mileage. Or actually, to run longer than a 50K without getting injured, and especially for somebody like me with no running base and no running history, it just requires too much mileage, and I just don't want to run that much. Like, it's just too much time away from climbing and too much of a hit to my climbing, especially because I'm never going to be a great runner. I'm kind of like, is it worth like not climbing in order to be a mediocre runner? It's like, I don't care that much. Yeah, like running a 50K or running a marathon, like that's freaking fine. Because that I can do with like sort of minimal, you know, some effort, but not too much.
Well, I'm going to push back. I think you could be an outstanding runner. I mean,
what we're fascinated by, like from a pure training perspective, we have a lot more deep questions. Our listeners out there are like, David, ask him serious questions. But, you know, from a training perspective, the climbing you do that is like immortalized in all these films and things, it's a fatigue resistance event. Like, clearly there is something that goes beyond just the skill of climbing and enters into the being able to sustain the skill of climbing for this extended period of time at an extremely high level that goes beyond just practice.
Well, that's the thing. It's actually not that high a level, though. Most of the things that I'm doing for really, really long periods of time, like doing the Hurt, the big traverse in Red Rock, it's just, it's so low level, you know, especially relative to my actual max. Yeah. You know, it's like the hardest route I did was, the guide calls it 10C. It's probably 11A. It's like, it's kind of hard. I think it's kind of hard. But yeah. But either way, I mean, 11A is, I don't know, like 12 grades or more below my max. You know, it's like so far within your comfort zone that it's just, I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, it's like ultra running or something where you're just so far below your actual max pace that you can just keep doing it for 12 hours, 18 hours, whatever.
That's fascinating. So you've raised the ceiling so high that, I mean, does that even apply to things like, you know, the big walls where, you know, you're out there for a number of hours? I mean, some of those moves at the top from my limited understanding are still pretty difficult. So, I mean,
yeah,
aren't
but
you
it's at this-
that point?
It's the same principles, though, with running, where you'd be running at a moderate pace for a long period of time, and then you're keeping enough in reserve that you can sprint pretty hard at, you know, up one hill or something like that. You know, and it's like, and you just know how much you have in the tank, and you know how hard you can go. That, like, if you have to overtake somebody on the last hill, like, you can. You know, I mean, I think that's kind of the analogy with climbing like that.
Well, it's very cool. So they have a lot of studies on runners that look at, like, extensor strength and how it changes after athletes have been under a huge amount of load. So, like thousands of kilojoules worth of work. And there are some people who just electrically, like, the neuromuscular signaling doesn't degrade as much as others, almost independent of what they do. And that's kind of, like, one place where, you know, from a training perspective, we wanted to see if we could learn something from you, because we call it fatigue resistance as, like, a general overarching thing. But, like, is there anything you do in particular with your climbing training, let's say, to train the ability to perform high at a high level after a few hours? So, like, the equivalent of that, and here I'm not talking about the days where you go out and you spend a ton of time on the wall or whatever and climbing. Is there any, non-climbing thing that you do to support that on, like, a daily basis?
No, I don't know. Not in general, but I don't know. I mean, this morning I went for a long mountain bike ride with a friend. So I went for like a 5.5 hour mountain bike ride, which was more than I hoped for. And it's the first time I've ridden a bike in over a year, I think, because I've been running. And it's like, I really only have space for one kind of cardio in my life. And, and so mountain biking got totally supplanted by running. But,
your taint's pretty sore for a week now.
Yeah, I did. I was kind of like, man, this is why I don't like, I do think I like running more. So I was like, biking is just so painful and like, yeah. And so many things you have to worry about and hitting things. And it's like more dangerous. So I was like, I don't know. I kind of like running more now, but anyway, I don't know. The fatigue resistance stuff is interesting. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if for whatever, like some innate physiological reason, I am maybe a little more resistant of fatigue like that, because that is one thing that has always come relatively easily to me. It's just being able, or sort of like, I've always maintained a steady decline, you know, like some people bonk, some people get totally worked. I basically start at a certain point and then I just grind myself to dust in like sort of a long linear way for seemingly, you know, I mean, at least 24 hours or more, you know, it's like, I'm just slowly getting worse until eventually I'm destroyed. But there's no, there hardly ever big drops or spikes or anything. It's just like, you just keep going until you can't anymore.
That's fascinating.
A lot of our athletes that have excellent fatigue resistance, they've seen that and they know that they've had that from a young age. Is this something that, I mean, it can be in various things. So sometimes athletes that have outstanding fatigue resistance, they're really good at partying. So they can, you know, they can stay up to 3 a.m. and party consistently and it doesn't seem to impact them in life. Is this something that you've seen in your life that you've had this like outstanding measure of fatigue resistance either from a young age or in other areas?
I don't know. I've never really done anything except for climb or hike or, you know, those kinds of things. I would say that more than many of my friends, I think I have a high capacity to do work travel basically nonstop. Like the Free Solo film tour, when the documentary Free Solo came out, I did like 6 months, what I called my deployment to Hollywood, where I basically traveled and did events nonstop for 6 months. And it was totally insane. Where like some days, you know, it's two cities in the same day where you like wake up in one city, you fly to another, you do an event, and then you fly to a third city and then do an event there that night. And you're like, geez Louise, you know, it's the kind of travel schedule that seems like it would kill you, but just, you know, you just kind of get used to it and it just becomes the grind. It's like, but yeah, I've never done anything like, I don't party. So I've kind of missed that side of it.
We don't either. We'd be good friends.
Megan, you apparently had a party stage before I came around.
I had an 8-month party stage, and then I fully gave up on it, and we've gone the opposite direction.
You have outstanding fatigue resistance, and I don't, so maybe you're proving your own point here.
The 8-month party was essential to it.
Yeah. So, I mean, Free Solo brings up a really interesting point here, in that, I mean, for us personally, we saw it in theaters, one of our most cherished moments of our whole life. A lot of people feel that way, even if they're not climbing fans. Just so meaningful to us to see this. And so we were like cheering, didn't know it was going to happen, even though we did. And as you have created this thing that is going to live forever, how do you feel about it now, a few years later, looking back? Like, is it all just good feelings, or is part of you feel like kind of yucky about it? Or is there any mixed feelings in there?
No, I'm so psyched. It's great. I mean, it's a great film. They did a great job. It's beautiful. It really does justice to El Cap. It's like,
yeah.
I mean, it's highlighting one of the best climate, I mean, maybe the best climate experience of my life. You know, if someone's going to make a film about something you do, it may as well be one of the things that you're most proud of in life. You know, it's like, I mean, everything about it is great. You know,
yeah. If someone makes a film and it gets a 12% on Rotten Tomatoes about your life's work, you're like, motherfucker, it was not worth it.
Totally. No, that's the thing, is like, the filmmakers did an incredible job. The film turned out great. People love the film. I'm proud of it. You know, I'm proud of the climb itself and the work that we put into making the film, because, I mean, those are kind of separate things. I mean, it was still a lot of effort to actually make the film good and, you know, shoot things and like all the time with the crew and stuff. I don't know. I mean, everything about it. And then the fact, and the whole Academy Award journey of like spending months promoting the film and doing events nonstop, and then it freaking won an Academy Award, and you're like, oh shit. You know, it's like, it really... No, I'm only the producers and director get the actual statues.
That's
what
lame.
The fuck?
I know. That's lame.
Well, because, I mean, it is an award ceremony for filmmakers, you know. It's not like,
I don't know.
But they didn't Free Solo for it.
Yeah. Also,
I feel like they should just, the filmmakers should take that and give it to you. You did the heavy lifting.
Favorite parts were the one-liners from you throughout the movie. But the reason I wanted to talk about that is more the external validation concept of all this, in that clearly, you know, you've had to play a game to a certain extent. I mean, everyone from the outside, we get the feeling that you could take it or leave it, like you wouldn't play it if you didn't have to. But for young climbers and young people that are coming up in this sport, they have to play the game, but play it in a way that like is much more active at sometimes, I imagine. Like, I mean, granted, you're doing two podcasts and
do they have to play the game?
Do you think so? You don't think they do?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I don't, you know, it depends. I mean, I think you definitely can play the game if you want to. And actually, I listened, I think, to your last podcast where you guys were talking about sponsorship and, you know, how it's relatively hard with running and, which is not that dissimilar with climbing. I mean, it's probably pretty similar to ultra running, where it's a relatively small community, you know, not that much money to go around in it. I mean, actually, I bet climbing is probably bigger than ultra running at this point. I don't know.
We just actually had that discussion. I'm not sure.
I imagine it is. I mean, once you know, there's not going to be an ultra running Oscar winning film anytime soon.
That's a good point.
I mean, maybe on the
actually, trivial. You never know.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone just describes their journey with chafing and it makes the reviewers cry and they get the Oscar. But I mean, yeah, I mean, yes, I think climbing does have more of a bigger pot. But at the same time, like, you know, to push back, if you're a 20-year climber, like, if a tree falls in the forest, no one's going to hear it, especially if that tree is not a fucking redwood, like Alex Honnold or, you know, and one of the other famous climbers. You know, if they're just like someone that wants to make a living in the sport, but just isn't quite at that level. Is there a way to like balance the competing demands on?
Well, I think that's the key thing. If you're not quite at that level, then yeah, you can kind of make a living through self-promotion, through, you know, coaching, through whatever, like, you know, teaching, route setting clinics, like all kinds of like random things. And you can kind of scrape it all. You can make it work. I think the better way is just be at that level. You know, it's like, because the thing is, I think if you're at the right level, then the things you do speak for themselves. Like, I think that you don't really need to worry about your followers and all that kind of shit if you're doing stuff that's cutting edge. You know, I think that, yeah. I mean, I sort of became a sponsored climber like slightly before smartphones and social media and all that kind of stuff. But basically, I just did a handful of things that hadn't been done in 20 years. Mm-hmm. And a few, you know, basically, I met a few people and like a guy who knew a guy. And then that guy sorted me out with some free shoes for a while. Yeah, like one of the guys worked at Black Diamond, the climbing company, and he happened to play in a band with the president of La Sportiva, if you know you know, running shoes, but the shoe company. Yeah. And so for a little while, I just had the president of Sportiva's email address to be like, you know, get some free shoes when you want. But I was like so embarrassed and sort of, I felt so weird emailing the CEO or whatever. I was like, oh, I can't ask the boss. And so, you know, I'd never reach out. And then eventually he sorted me out with the athlete manager or whatever. And, you know, I slowly got onto some teams that way. But it was all pretty organic, and it just happened because I was doing things that people hadn't done, really. And, you know, so few people notice, a few people are interested. You know, it's like you just kind of, like, if, I mean, I'm sure with running, like, if you win enough races, someone's going to give you free shoes. And so it's like, yeah, you could be an influencer, you could be whatever, but I mean, the best way is just to freaking win.
I love that. And on one side you have, if it happens, it happens, put yourself out there. On the other side, you have taking butt crack photos in front of mountains, and probably you can avoid that. And I mean, I agree, that actually summarizes how we've tried to frame it a little bit.
It's actually a good question of how many races do you have to win before you get sponsored without an Instagram account? I'd be curious to know. Yeah. I think it would actually be a substantial number, I think, in ultra running.
I mean, I guess it gets back to the kind of culture of the sports that might have some variance, so it's tough to know.
That stuff is weird, though, because, I mean, social media could die in the next couple years, or, I mean, change forms, you know, go to just TikTok or, like, Snapchat or whatever. Like, it wouldn't be shocking if Instagram sort of falls off over the next couple years. Yeah. And then it's just kind of a weird thing, because, like, if your career is based on being a Instagram influencer, kind of like, that's freaking weird. Like, what happens when the platform dies? Like, what happens when Twitter goes under and you're sort of like, all my followers, you know, like, do you have anything? You know what I mean? It's like, ultimately, I think, I mean, I've always said this to any climber. It's like, you just have to be able to do the thing. Like, other people have to look at you and be like, whoa, like, that person is a really good climber. And it's like, that speaks for itself.
We're not on TikTok. I would love to see an Alex Honnold TikTok.
That'd be pretty great.
That'd be very fun.
I don't think you would. That'd be bad.
It kind of flashed before my eyes there. I was like, well, if social media dies, then podcasts could die, and then we're nothing. Then we are meaningless. But, you know, one follow-up on that. Like, do you ever, like, I mean, I imagine the answer is pretty simple, but do you ever have yourself thinking about how will this be perceived? Because, like, I preach all these, you know, fucking new age Buddhist principles about athletics. And it's kind of, we created a book called The Happy Runner that starts talking about death. And at the same time, sometimes I'll be like, you know, we're putting this on Strava, and, like, I'm thinking about, like, that, even if it's not my primary motivator. Do you ever have those feelings that just kind of gnaw at you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if they gnaw at me, but I think there's the realistic recognition that people will care, or that, you know, people will think about what you've done. I mean, especially, free soloing to some extent is slightly polarizing. I mean, people always have opinions because it's like, it's risky. You're encouraging kids to take risk or whatever. So, I mean, there are some, you know, and sometimes justified criticisms of free soloing. I mean, that's all fair. I mean, especially around Boulder, because, I mean, you guys living in Boulder, like, there have been a bunch of terrible accidents around Boulder, and people falling an Eldo, and, like, I mean, Boulder of all places has, like, a lot of baggage around free soloing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's fair. I don't know. I mean, I definitely think about that stuff. It's like, I think it'd be disingenuous to be like, oh, you know, I'm just doing my own thing. I'm like, yeah, it's true that I would probably be doing the same things either way, but you can at least know, or at least think about the impact that they're going to have before you do them. Like, when I was working on Free Soloing El Cap, and, you know, there's a film crew and the whole thing, I mean, I knew that if I did it, it would be a big freaking deal. You know, it's like, I knew that the film would be good and everything about, you know, I knew that it would make being a professional climber much easier for the whole rest of my life. I mean, that was clear. But I still wanted to do it. You know, it's like, I wanted to do it first and foremost. It's just a bonus that everything else would be great.
In a lot of the film comments, there's, like, all this speculation about your amygdala and fear and different things about your brain state. Does that ever bother you? I think that would drive me nuts to have people, like, you know, you Google Alex Honnold and amygdala pops up, or fear pops up, and there's, you know, speculation about your brain or your ability to process fear or things like that. Does that drive you nuts?
Megan's a neuroscience expert, and every time that this conversation happens, she's like, why are we fucking speculating about someone's brain?
It's very strange. Yes. Does that bother you?
No, it's not that much. What bothers me is that scene in the film is like a 30-second scene, but it was taken because this print journalist wrote this, like, long form article for Nautilus magazine, some science magazine. And so it was, like, way more nuanced, way more in depth. You know, it was, like, a much more interesting and sort of enriching process. Like, I mean, doing the article with the journalist, I was like, oh, this is really interesting. I learned a lot about this woman who was studying high sensation seeking individuals who are mostly gamblers and addicts and things. And I was like, oh, this is all really interesting. I did all these personality tests. But then the scene that's in the film is just this short little, you know, and people are like, there's something wrong with his brain. And you're like, oh, it's slightly annoying that anybody that watches the movie just comes out of it with, like, there's something wrong with his brain. And you're like, well, it's a lot more nuanced, but whatever.
Yeah.
It's like,
that's what I was thinking as I was watching the movie. I was like, this is an unfair representation.
And anyone that's ever been around the best world-class athletes in any sport knows that it doesn't mean that something's wrong. It just means that something has been honed in such a way that it is different than it might present in other humans. And that's like, I mean, we coach some of the best in the world in ultras, and we're like, you know, if you showed this same type of thing in any part of their motivation process, you'd be like, okay, that person has a screw loose or whatever. But the point is, yeah. No, that's just what they like. That's what they've
developed. If somebody's winning ultra marathons, they for sure have some shit going on. You know, yeah. It's like, if for mainstream society, you'd be like, that person is just not normal. And that's great. I mean, as you guys say, you know, every episode I've listened to, like, let your freak flag fly, you know, like, celebrate you, like, all those kinds of things. I'm like, yeah, I'm into it. But certainly anyone winning ultras is just not normal. You know, it's like, because yeah. It's just too much pain and suffering and, like, long-term suffering and... You know, I mean, it's hard.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we say let the freak flag fly because all we have is a freak flag. So we're like, well, what else are we going to fly?
We actually need to design a freak flag at this point with just like tons of glitter and like random stuff and fly it outside for the heck of it. I think for both of us, we both felt that like lack of normalcy compared to like the general population early in our lives. And that was something that really brought us together. But did you feel that from a young age? Like, was that a defining part of who you were, of just, you know, feeling a little bit different early on?
Maybe. I don't know. I've never really thought of it that way, but I've definitely always just been on my, like, you know, I mean, I was climbing in the gym when gym climbing wasn't a thing, you know, like it wasn't really cool in 1996 or whatever, or like 95, like there weren't that many gyms. There weren't that many people doing it. Like nobody at my school climbed. Like I was the only kid that was into rock, you know, I was in the yearbook as like, he's the guy that rock climbs. Cause I'd like gone to nationals and stuff. And it's like, oh wow. He's like, he's rock climbing a lot. Like, what does that mean? But the thing is, it didn't feel, you know, I wasn't like, oh, I'm a rebel. I don't know. I was just like, I'm just doing my own thing. Like, I like doing this. I'm going to do it. F everybody.
Would you ever feel any like urge to fit in? I mean, because like I was that kid in a very different way from a young age. And I mean, I remember being in college and just being like, I need to change to fit in. And fortunately I met Megan, who kind of, you know,
let your freak flag fly. She was like, fly that flag.
You unfurled the freak flag. Yeah.
Ooh.
That's a metaphor. That's a euphemism.
I was going to say that better be a metaphor. That's not a metaphor. I'm very sad.
But yeah, did you ever feel the urge to be like, dude, should I be normal?
Not really. I don't know. I'm just like, who cares? You know, like I've never drank and, you know, everybody drinks because it's like the normal thing, but I'm like, oh, it's so gross. I think it tastes gross. It makes you feel gross. You know, I'm like, why would you do that? That's stupid. You know, and there are a lot of societal things. I'm like, why would you do that? That's dumb. And it just seems like obvious that you just shouldn't do that. But
how about drugs? I feel like a big part of like climbing culture is, you know, THC and mushrooms and psilocybin and this and that. Is that something that has helped you or anything that you...
No, never done any of that stuff either. I mean, now as an adult, I've like dabbled in, you know, I've like tried some things once and like basically don't know, don't care. Like not that I understood.
We interviewed Courtney DeWalter and she was talking about hallucinations in the middle of a 200 mile race. And it sounded pretty game changing. So David and I were debating whether we should run a 200 mile or do mushrooms. And mushrooms was probably the easier
winner. Mushrooms is the clear winner.
Yes.
I've had small hallucinations like that from fatigue. Like in Patagonia, I had a 54-hour push once, sort of like a survival experience escaping the mountains. And by the hike out, was like basically seeing and hearing things that weren't like, not like little green men, but like it was raining, it was storming. And so the rocks were all shimmering and you kept thinking like, oh, it must be like glass or like something sparkling. Like there must be a person around every corner. And it's like, we're in the middle of freaking nowhere and there are definitely no people. But you're like, I keep thinking I'm hearing somebody. I think, you know, I kept thinking I was like walking into somebody's camp because it's like things are sparkling and I'm hearing things. And you're like, I think I was just totally tripping. Because when you're going through your second night with no sleep and like exercising nonstop for 54 hours, you're like, you're just not quite at your best. You know, so things start to happen.
Yeah. I feel like in the parenting journey, we might get a few hallucinations yet if he has some sleep regression. So on your like little bit of a, we want to get to some super fun questions, but first, you're 37 now. Have you noticed a change with your climbing? So, you know, we think so much about aging as coaches because, you know, we coach a lot of pro athletes in their 40s, let's say, and, you know, you need to slightly shift the way you do things. Have you noticed the need to shift in the way you do your training and performances?
I don't know. I would say that this year actually is maybe the first time that I'm starting to think a little like, oh, I just don't feel like I'm recovering quite as quickly, or like little injuries, not like sport injuries, but just like, oh, my back is tweaked or something. It's just like taking longer to recover, you know, things like that. Or like, oh, you know, my muscle is sore and then it's like still sore 3 days later. And you're like, WTF, like, why is this not resolved after one day? But, you know, it's hard to say how much of that. I mean, obviously aging plays into that. I mean, part of it, though, I think is just having our daughter and just sleeping less and just being generally a little more pooped and I don't know. It's hard to say, but I do feel like this year is the first year that I'm like, you know, I might be sort of cresting into middle age here.
Yeah. Does that weigh on you all at all mentally? So I know when I first met David, I think David was lamenting about aging at age 23 and like thinking about that process. Is that anything that you think about or that weighs on you at all?
Not that much. I mean, I think that climbing has more longevity than most sports, just because it's not purely strength based. Like, there's such a technical component to it. And climbing as a professional climber, so much of it can be around first ascents and exploration and things like that, where you don't even have to be at your physical peak. So you can be a professional climber like well into your 50s or, you know, until 60, depending on like what you've done. So I'm not too stressed about that side of it. But I don't know, at the same time, I want to do hard things, and I'm like, oh, I just don't want my body to give up too soon.
Yeah, it's like the Alexander Hamilton, so much to do before I go. Yeah, I mean, like for me, I'm progressing more than ever, but I feel like coming to terms with the fact that I've had to change things slightly or at least be aware of it has been super helpful, because, you know, feeling old since you're 23 makes you feel like, wow, I'm still crushing it. I'm proud of myself.
You're like, my middle age is lasting so long.
I know, right? I'm like, sure. I've been at the horizon for so long. I'm just like, this is beautiful.
Actually, as soon as we had, so we just had Leo six weeks ago. And as soon as we had him, I felt younger for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I'm like, now things are like, I don't know. There's a little bit more purpose outside.
That's good. It's because you finally shed your parasite and you're like, I feel free. I feel young. I feel alive. Like, yeah.
Pooping on a parasite is like the best feeling in the entire world. But how has the parenting journey been for you both? You've been big inspirations for us. When we were pregnant, I was going through some of your quotes on parenthood, and they were outstanding. It was, you know, the kind of the vibe of, you know, when June is 16, she might not think about breastfeeding or some of these different things. And it was really just like such a sigh of relief reading your quotes and thinking about just like the chill approach to parenthood. How has it been for you?
Oh yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, it's our first child, so I'm learning as I go too. And, you know, we'll see. But no, it's been great. I mean, she's a really chill baby. There are no complaints. That said, I mean, I personally just don't love infants the way, you know, I'm excited for family sort of long term. I'm excited to like play with my daughter.
Yeah.
And the first year just feels like you're just, you know, I was kind of like, it's just too bad that we're not like other mammals. Like, I feel like she should gestate another 9 months or so and come out like walking.
But just come out whatever. Like a gazelle and you'll immediately like shoot hoops with her. No, I feel the same way. I feel seen right now because everyone's like, you know, I wasn't sure. And then the baby popped out and I just loved the baby with all my heart.
Oh, no, like, I hate all that stuff. I'm like, come on. It's just like a terrible time suck of like labor and effort. And, you know, I mean, she's incredibly cute and she's great. And she's developing more and more personality. And like, she's more fun to be around. I mean, everything about it, I would say, is steadily improving. Yeah. But certainly the first couple of months you're like, dude, this is really what I, you know, like, I'm glad that this isn't what I'm doing the rest of my life. Cause this is not like, I'm willing to put in the time to get to having a nice child, but like an infant is just not, it doesn't do anything.
I feel this so deeply.
I feel like the first few days we were trying to do so many different like stimulating things with Leo. Like David was doing all these workouts and we were reading all these books and we're still doing it. But if you kind of recognize it, he just kind of eats, sleeps and poops.
Yeah.
And no matter the amount of stimulation or David's exercises, David does a ton of tummy time. And
I feel like I've been given purpose as a coach here because I'm essentially like, okay, I can't do anything with this baby, but I can give it training. So I'm like already I'm traumatizing the baby like I'm Earl Woods over here.
Yeah, watch out. I do joke though that basically our daughter's lifestyle is that of a professional athlete, because she goes really hard for a couple hours and takes a nap and then eats some more and then goes hard for an hour or two and then takes a nap. I'm sort of like, wow, she's like a professional endurance athlete. You know, it's like she just like goes hard and then chills. I'm like, it's easy lifestyle.
How has the traveling been with her? So I've been on this like years long mission to get David to consider us buying a van at some point, and talking to you, I'm hoping this seals the deal. But have you traveled with June in the van yet? And what does that look like?
Yeah, we've done maybe a month or no, we've done like 2 months or 2.5 months or something with her in the van. Actually, it's really nice. We changed our van layout. So there's this little nook, like basically a baby bed underneath our bed. It's like a little extra nook thing under the bed. Yeah. It's like a little cupboard that she gets to live in. She does well. Actually, I think as an infant, it was almost better for her in the van because the world is so small. It's like she could see both of us and hear both of us at all times. It was like a nice, you know, it's a kid-sized world. I don't know. Yeah, it seemed great. I mean, I think it's just normal for her, and it allowed us to keep climbing in Yosemite and doing the things that we would normally do. And actually, when we first went into the van with her as an infant, I mean, she was 2 months old, maybe. It was actually easier for us as well, lifestyle-wise, because you just don't have to take care of your house. You know, it's like when you're in the van, it's like dishes are way simpler and like cleaning and like all the things are just simpler. And, you know, we were so behind on sleep and all those kinds of things. It was suddenly like when you put her down, you just get into bed because there's nothing else to do. And you're like, thank God we're actually resting for a change. You
know? It's an outstanding point, except for the fact that we don't really take care of our house anyways. So
yeah, it's kind of cutting up. It's kind of solving a problem there. So I'm just curious about this from my own. I would give myself on a scale of 1 to 10, like maybe a 3 on diaper changes. But given your ability with like climbing and how you have to be so good with the gear, what are you on a scale of 1 to 10 in diaper changes?
Oh, I think I'm fine. Yeah, I'm probably not as good as my wife, but no, I think I'm good. I'd give myself a solid 7.
You know? I feel like okay. I would give him a 10.
I was imagining just like this total like big wall experience every time you change a diaper. I was hoping.
Actually, the real big wall experience is that you have to poop in a bag so much. You know, I mean, if you're in big walls, you basically have to take care of your own poop like that. So you do kind of learn how to contain it and how to clean up and not destroy your surroundings by accident.
Oh, that is fascinating. Another parallel with ultra running, except I guess we just kind of go on the trail. But so
oh, but that's, I mean,
you have to pack it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're on El Cap, you have to pack it out. So it's a whole thing. You poop in the bag, you tape it up, you package it out.
Given how rigorous that process is, do you find yourself, I mean, do you really get into it in terms of when you're going ultra running? Like, do you dig a hole? Like, how does that work?
No. Anything while running is normally emergent, and you're just like, you know what? I'm in the middle of nowhere. It doesn't matter. Just like flip over a rock and call it good.
Perfect. Yeah.
Well, this episode will be heard by a lot more people probably. Like, this will probably be break the running podcast. I need to make sure all of our new listeners know Megan is the official proponent of there's no need to wipe in a run as long as it's not too long, because like you can just wipe when you get home and like clean off and stuff, and it saves so much time. So that's our public service announcement for today.
I would say it depends on the kind of poop, you know. Depends on what happens, because sometimes it's probably worth the extra 20 seconds to wipe just the whole rest of the race you're not. Yeah,
in 2013 she knew I was going to propose to her on this run. Literally 45 seconds before I propose, she just does it like a horse on the side of the trail and then just keeps running. So every one of those beautiful photos that we posted so helpfully on Instagram, just really good thing they don't have smells in them.
It was good practice. All of my Strava files in terms of bathroom breaks are no longer than 15 seconds. I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, when Megan's won like national championships, I'll be like, oh, there's 15 seconds of stoppage time. That was really efficient. Oh, good job, Megan.
And this is why I'm not an elite runner. You know, because I'm like, I just don't quite care that much.
And it gets back to the brain scan thing we talked about. It's like, that doesn't come from someone with a spotless brain scan. So, you know, the one thing I wanted to ask you is the idea of the burden of genius. So this amazing article came out on Andrew Luck, who was the quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts the other week, who retired at 29. And essentially, he was considered himself to have to be the best quarterback because he was always the best quarterback. And then, I mean, it infiltrated every other part of his life to the point that he was ordering meals for people at dinner because quarterbacks need to be control freaks. And I was wondering for you, so you've demonstrated this genius your whole life. Is there any burden there, especially in the sense that, like, you know, you have this family now and you're thinking like, you know, what does the future hold? Is there anything like, oh, I need to keep climbing forever and this is just who I am and I need to keep doing it or I'm nothing? Is there anything like that?
No. I mean, well, I don't know. I would push back on all of that. I'm like, I wouldn't say I've ever really had any genius either, though, because I've never had any of the youth talent. Like, I did all the youth competitions as a kid, but I basically never won. I consistently got second or third in my youth categories. Yeah. Except that a couple of the kids that I was competing against wound up becoming professional climbers as well. Like, just by sheer chance, several of us from Northern California all wound up being professional climbers. But so a couple of them were truly talented, and so they opted out of the youth stuff and started just competing as adults when they were like 14. Yeah. So then I actually started winning a little bit because all the competitors left. I was like, I'm the only one still competing as a youth. Now I can win my youth category. But no, I mean, there was definitely no genius. You know, it's like if you had seen 19-year-old me rock climbing, you would never have thought that I would wind up doing anything of note, really. I mean, you'd be like, oh yeah, he's a pretty good climber, like he's got some talent, you know. Like I went to the Youth World Cup when I was 18 or 19 and I got like 40th or something in the world, or 45th, you know. It's like basically it was like totally average, but I went there more as like a travel experience. So I'm like, I'm going to Scotland, this is crazy. Like I knew that I wasn't good, you know, that I'd only really qualified at nationals because nobody competed in my age group anymore. But you know, I was still like, cool, I get an opportunity to go to Europe. But nothing about that screams climbing genius. You know, it's like there's so many child prodigies who like at age 14 are doing some of the hardest routes in the world. And I mean, like actually even nowadays, I mean, there are a bunch of 14-year-olds that climb harder grades than I've ever climbed. And wow. So, you know, there's no real genius as a climber. It's just that, you know, I've just kind of taken my own path and just done a bunch of things that hadn't been done before, which, I mean, in some ways is maybe the real lesson to like, if you want to be a professional climber, a big part of it is just doing things that are new or different style or whatever. I mean, there's a big expression of creativity more than just the pure physical achievement. Because by any physical measure of climbing, I'm just not that great of a climber. You know, it's like, I don't know. I mean, it'd be hard to quantify what makes me a great climber.
Do you feel like going from world class to transcendent, is that an element of like hard work? So like the story for me, we talk about it all the time in our own lives. When we're making that hard choice is you did some big thing. I don't want to, very technical term. You did a big thing, but then you went on the hangboard for a couple hours or whatever your workout was after. Do you think that that's what did it? Or is it just kind of this taking your own path element?
I think it's taking your own path. Because, I mean, the thing is, the workout that I did on my hangboard after freestyling all cap was really lackluster, you know? And it's like other climbers, like, yeah, it's funny because when I topped out all cap, I was like, I feel like a boss. I could do anything. I could do it again. And then I went down and did my normal afternoon workout and was like, wow, I'm objectively quite tired. You know, I'm actually, like, my arms are really fatigued and I'm really just not doing what I thought I could do. But that's fine. But yeah. No, I mean, the hangboard workouts that I'm doing are, you know, comically easy for somebody who's elite in that category of climbing. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, it's not like I'm doing these crushing hangboard workouts. It's like, I'm just trying to stimulate my fingers. Like my fingers are probably my weakest thing as a climber. Like it's probably the thing I'm worst at in climbing. And so, you know, for me working on my weaknesses, it's like, it's pretty mediocre compared to truly elite climbers. Wow. But, you know, you just have to, you know, you do your best with what you have.
How about on a similar measure, the burden of perfectionism? So I think, you know, to freestyle a LCAP, everything needs to be perfect and everything has to go perfectly and according to plan. Do you find that level of perfectionism that's needed to do that transfer to other areas of life?
No, I think as I've gotten older, I've gotten a lot better about that. I think that that growing up, there was maybe more of an emphasis on like, you know, don't do it unless it's perfect. And as an adult, I'm like, you know what? You only really have to be great at a few things. And even that at a few moments. And like, you only have to make the right moments count. The rest of the time, you can just do what needs to be done. You can just have the experience, like keep plowing forward, you know, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Now I'm very much more of like, you know, if it's good enough, just keep moving. It's like relentless forward progress. Just keep moving forward.
And like kind of on that note, I mean, the question that is the most annoying question, I think, for like anyone that's been around like world class athletes is when you're asked about, you know, death essentially in these things. So this isn't a question about that, but this is a question about like thinking about impermanence as it relates to things like you only have so many walls to climb, your child's born now, you have all these things. Is like the impermanence of it something that is like, do you find yourself thinking about that, or are you just kind of living in the moment day to day?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I guess I think about that a fair amount. I mean, I definitely think about the fact that soon enough, you know, sooner rather than later, the whole professional climbing thing will slowly wind down and I'll just be, you know, a middle-aged dad who loves climbing all the time. But the thing is, I mean, I kind of look at that fondly because I'll still be doing exactly the same thing. I mean, I love climbing. I'll be climbing all the time. So when the whole professional side winds down, I'll just be like, sweet, I have more time to climb. You know, it's like I'm not too stressed about it. Like climbing was in the Olympics for the first time in 2020, though it wound up getting pushed to 2021. But I was kind of like, man, this is great because this is going to be the next sort of generation of climbing heroes. You know, like these are the people who are all going to replace me. I was like, you know what? That is fine by me. Like the free solo tour had just wound down. It was all like, you know, I was like, it's time to get replaced. And that hasn't quite happened yet, but you know, wait for 2024 in Paris or whatever, you know, at some point there'll be like the next generation of heroes. And I'm like, great. Like, I can't wait to just pass the torch and go back to doing, well, actually not even go back to, I'll just keep doing exactly what I'm doing. I just won't, you know, like that's great.
Do you ever have moments where you wake up in the morning, this happens to both of us all the time, it's a random Wednesday, and just like, why the heck are we doing this? Like, why do we do this sport? Does that ever enter your mind in terms of climbing? Like, why am I doing this? Like, do you ever think deeply about that?
No, I freaking love climbing. I think that's actually a key difference between climbing and running and some other things. I mean, when I listen, you know, I've listened to several of your podcasts now, and when you talk about like different types of training things and, you know, like 8x12 by 1 minute, like whatever increments and like intervals and like heart rate stuff, I'm like, fuck, that all sounds like such a bore. Like, it's so, so hard. And like, and the thing is, I know it's physically painful and like physically difficult, and you don't feel great while you're doing it. And climbing, at least for me, is so fun. It's like every day you just go out, you have a big adventure, you climb a thing, you try your hardest, you solve some problems. It's like, it's fun. And so I don't know. I just think fundamentally it's easier to train for that kind of thing because I actually enjoy everything about the process. Actually, speaking of, can I get to my questions for you guys?
Let's do it.
Am I allowed to have some questions? Okay. Well, so first up, and part of me was like, is it embarrassing to ask you guys questions? But then I was like, honestly, I bet half your listeners wonder the same things, but don't know how to ask you guys. Because they're like, it's too embarrassing. But so you guys talk about strides all the time. What are strides?
Oh my God. Well, first, this is the ultimate through the looking glass moment. So I want to acknowledge that for the listeners out there that yes, I am shitting a brick as well. Strides are like 15 to 30 second short accelerations that have outsized benefits on neuromuscular.
Yeah, I've heard all the benefits, but I'm like, what do you actually do?
Oh yeah, great. Even easier. You just go, you take 5 to 10 seconds to accelerate to the fastest pace you can sustain comfortably using long distance form. Hold that for, you know, 15 to 30 seconds and then slow down. So
you say long distance form, is that different than sprinting?
Yeah, very important not to sprint. So you want it to feel relaxed and comfortable. Like if you had to, you could keep running at this pace for another mile. Whereas sprinting, you do a 100-meter sprint and you're about done.
And that has to do with like one, anaerobic energy generation, which you don't really want in running, similar to how you do want it in fast sport climbing, like the Olympic stuff. And two, injury risk. So for someone like you, for example, those done on hills, so like 15 to 30 second, just slight accelerations up hills, will have like a pretty massive benefit to your running economy. I mean, the studies show that when you take an athlete with your type of base and talent, they'll see like a 6 to 10% benefit from doing 4x20 to 30 seconds, you know, a few times in a month, even. Like it's wild how big the benefits are over time.
And they sound boring and mundane. Like 8x30 seconds doesn't sound like the most fun thing in the world, but they're actually, I mean, you can actually make them fun and like play. We have some athletes do them oftentimes on smooth terrain, but you could do them on technical terrain too. In terms of like building neuromuscular proprioception and things like that.
So when I'm on a casual jog, if I just run up the hills faster, that would be better for me?
Well, no,
because for small periods of time.
Yeah. And it needs to be in like the semi-structured manner, but yeah, for 15 to 20 seconds, perfect. Like that's all you need to do. Just be careful about injuries, since you know.
Wait, how many times? What are you doing exactly?
So let's say in the second half of one of your normal runs, like your 5 mile run, when you come to an uphill, you don't even need to make it a repeat. You can just do like 15 to 20 second accelerations to this fastest pace you can maintain while still running with good form and comfortably. And then take a minute or two of easy running for recovery and then do it again.
And how many times total?
4 to 6.
Oh yeah. Okay. Okay. I'm like, I can manage that.
It's important, let your heart rate drop on the intervals, because the delta, so like the difference in the heart rate, so as your heart rate spikes up, it's really good for cardiac stroke output. So really important to like really let yourself recover and chill out.
Yeah.
As you're starting the next stride, you should look forward to it as opposed to dread it.
Disclaimer, if we get Alex Honnold injured, we were going to be the shame.
I'm going to be so sad.
In the whole athletic community. So do what you do. You're perfect.
I can't run for beans. I've never had any running. You know, I was like, running is heinous. But what actually, basically the core of the questions I want to ask you guys were, how do I maintain some kind of running base without having to run that much? Because basically like running a bunch of miles is just too much. You know, as a climber, it's like, I'd rather spend the time training for climbing, but I do want to maintain some running base and I do want to run an ultra next year. It's like, you know, what's the bare minimum ideally to make some gains as a run, you know, because like right now I don't feel like I have any long-term running base. Like if I just didn't run for a month, I'd be like, oh, my legs feel terrible. Like what does it take to maintain a running base?
It's actually probably less than you think. And a lot of it is for that biomechanical development. That way, when you go to run, you don't get atrociously sore like I did coming back postpartum. I would say, I mean, I'm curious your answer, David. My answer would be 4 days, 4 days a week, 15 to 20 minutes of running would be outstanding for maintaining your running base. Honestly, even 2 to 3 days in terms of like musculoskeletal gains, probably great. And then if you could mix in cross training too, from like an aerobic standpoint, that would be great.
Well, the thing with climbing is you get so much zone one because you hike to and from the crag every day. So you do a lot of just like hiking uphill with a heavy backpack. So it's like you kind of get a lot of the base, you know, like zone one casual. But yeah, I was kind of wondering, I mean, if I was just going for an hour jog twice a week, you think that's enough to then build off of later in the year?
So you have capillaries and mitochondria for days, right? Like from all of your aerobic work that you've done over time. But your mechanical system, as it relates to running, is just underdeveloped to an extent that will not
happen. Yeah, that's exactly what I experience.
It will not happen through 2 1-hour runs. But interestingly, running is so frequency responding. It's such a frequency responding event that, you know, the 2 hour runs, if that same amount of time was spread over 4 runs, would have a much bigger benefit for reinforcing the mechanical adaptations.
So you're saying I'm better off running 20 minutes 4 times a week than running, you know, 80 minutes once a week.
Absolutely. 100%. Yes, yeah. And that's why it's different than something like cycling. Like cyclists, if you just do one ride and do it once a week, you can actually progress pretty well if you're also working your strength through other means. Running, if you do that, even if you're able to avoid injury, it's going to feel so fucking foreign that it's going to be heinous. You know, like every part of it is going to be something that is almost a punishment. But you know, what we always say to athletes is 10 minute counts, 10 minutes count. And this includes world-class athletes. Like, you know, so for world-class athletes, we might be looking at trying to get to 13 runs a week through doubles. But a lot of those
that's like my nightmare. Yeah, yeah. If I run 13 times in a week, I'll be like, holy shit.
But those can be like 10 minutes and get some of the benefits. So basically just spreading it out slightly, especially with your kid, you know, it's probably, you know, you have more time availability to do the 10 minutes sometimes than the hour. And it might fit around your climbing too, where, you know, after you do a big climbing session, you can go out and do, you know, 10 or 15 minute jog real slow. It can be super slow. Like, you know, 10 or 15 minutes per mile even, and reinforce that, and then periodically throw in those hours, and then, you know, these hill strides once a week at the end of your run just for fun, like play style. And that'll leave this base there that transfers those, like, you know, mitochondria, those capillaries you have, into something that when you do decide to train for a 50K, you just need to do a few specific efforts, whether it's one of these big
length. Yeah, longer miles for me.
Yeah, and it only needs to be a few of those.
And for context, if I took 5 days off of training when I'm like really cooking and training, I would be very sore for 2 or 3 days. And so it makes sense that, you know, spreading that volume out is really helpful musculoskeletally. Also a good way to reduce injury too.
Yeah.
Now that kind of makes me sad though, because I'm like, I don't want to go running 4 days a week. You know, even if it's a shorter time, it's like that, then it feels like you're running all the time. I'm like,
it gets a lot
man.
Better though. That's a sweet spot. Like once you feel like you're running all the time, I promise it does get better.
And Alex, we don't give the easy answers here on the Some Work All Play podcast. Yeah,
totally.
We're like, it's all, yeah. But I mean, that, you know, if you're able
this
to
this is all work, angle, no play. I'm like, oh, yeah, man. Yeah. No, actually, it's funny you mentioned that, because that is actually exactly the same principle with climbing and finger development. It's like it's the frequency is more important than the legendary workout that you do once a week. Exactly. It's better to sort of stimulate your fingers every day, every other day, rather than do crushing workouts every once in a while.
And my guess is like, mechanical development. If that's a really interesting overlap that I'd never been aware of. You know, mechanical development is different, especially how it relates to the nervous system.
That, I mean, yeah, actually this afternoon, I haven't climbed in a day or two because I climbed a mountain yesterday. I went for a 5 hour bike ride today. I'm doing some random cardio stuff, but I was going to take like an hour to go bouldering after we chat, basically just to like maintain some fingers, which is exactly what you're describing with running. It's like, well, if you want to be able to do a sport, you got to just like keep doing the sport basically.
Yeah. And reinforcement, like through frequency, has just outsized benefits.
I love the quote, maintain some fingers. Anytime I go out for a run and I'm like needing the motivation for frequency, maintain some fingers is going to be my
that's going to be my Strava title.
You're maintaining your legs. You're like, you know, I'm just maintaining my legs. Like,
okay. Yeah. We don't want to take up too much more of your time.
Unless he has other questions. If you have any other questions, we're here for you.
No, I mean, basically, yeah, it was kind of like what base I listened to your episode with, always be building base. I'm thinking about getting my little tattoo. Cause I mean, climbers talk about that too, with sort of zone one and like hiking uphill nonstop. But I was like, what does base building look like when, you know, I mean, basically like all the hiking, like when you hike to the cliff, it's normally say half an hour with a backpack sort of uphill, you know, it's very casual pace. It's like conversational. You're like chatting, you know, I'm hiking with my wife and a baby or whatever, but obviously you're exercising. I'm like, does that count as building base? And like, is that useful or is that just a detriment to other training stuff?
Oh yeah. Hugely beneficial. I mean, essentially at the cellular level, it's all the same, right? And a really advanced athlete like you, I mean, you can go out and do climbing at essentially a level that would be almost non-taxing to you. And similarly, a runner can go out and do a run that is fully non-taxing if you were measuring any biomarker, anything like that. And all of it has at the cellular level the same chemical reactions that lead to, you know, the increased aerobic performance. So we're big fans of like, hey, the only reason we talk about weekly miles is because that's easy to measure. If we could actually quantify, you know, this always be base building framework, like you hang out with your family, it would add up and it would explain some of what we see. But the problem is we just can't measure it on Strava, so people avoid it.
My bet is that you have an outstanding base. I bet you your aerobic base. We talked about mitochondria in our last episode and backwards hat mitochondria. I bet you, Alex.
Yeah, no, I listened to that. I loved it. Yeah,
all of the backwards hat mitochondria. I can guarantee it. So I think have a lot of faith in your base because you know all that you know getting to the rock.
But how would you quantify that? Because I think if anybody did a measure of I don't know like my VO2 max or any kind of like aerobic test, like I don't think I would really excel compared to any other runner or cyclist or whatever.
So you know, there's a couple ways. I mean, one would be just your lipid metabolism, like your rates of lipid oxidation, my guess, are through the roof relative to other male athletes. Best way to measure it would be within the context of your sport where you're adapted. So if you measured it in like a low level climb or even a mid level climb,
yeah, it's true that I could do mid to low level climbing until like forever,
and
like,
even
until yeah. all my arms fall off.
Like actually during like the climb in free solo, did you fuel during that?
Yeah, I had like a little bar. I had like maybe two snacks. It's more just because, like, actually, and here's another question for you for training stuff. Actually, so I've been doing a bunch of cardio recently because I'm gonna climb some mountains this winter, and I've been sort of it's the types of workouts that I definitely probably could do without eating, but I've been sort of intentionally eating so that I don't feel hungry later in the day because it's like my lifestyle. Like I'm basically exercising like a big chunk of every day. And I just don't want to get home and then be like, now I'm really hungry and feel like I have to like build back. So I've just been like almost like overeating while I exercise just so it all feels totally normal. So when I get home, I don't even like need a huge meal. I'm just kind of like, oh, I'll just keep going. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Should I be eating more or less or does it matter? Because like in a way of like my pendulum has kind of swung to like, oh, I'm eating more than I normally would have. Because in the past, I would have just kind of like dug myself into more of a hole and then just like, you know, recovered afterward.
I mean, I think it's probably great for recovery, actually. I think the one detriment potentially for a male athlete is, you know, just thinking about aerobic metabolism and lipid oxidation and the efficiency of that. But my bet is that you have so much base and so much backward hat mitochondria that your lipid metabolism is already really optimized. And so I don't think you need to do a ton of training there in terms of like more fasted training. So I think it's probably fine.
So what you did when you were young, that essentially builds up this reserve where your fat burning is not going to improve from where you are. Like you've already optimized that to the max. So in that context, you want to fuel everything you possibly can, I imagine, especially as an athlete approaches like their mid to late 30s, because there's a huge hormonal impact. Like the endocrine system is what gets hit the hardest by underfueling an event. You know, if you do that and you measure, I mean, there's studies that measure within day energy deficits. So we're not even talking about like people that don't eat enough overall. They're getting enough over the course of a day, but just within day, they're having more extended periods of time where they're like in 400 calorie deficits or whatever. Those athletes' testosterone to cortisol ratios fucking suck. And it really manifests in other physical issues. So injuries and under adaptation too.
Potency. I know you love the word potency.
Oh yes. My God. You better
hard,
believe
hard
it.
To conceive, you know? Yeah.
No, seriously. Oh my God. When we talk about this issue, we sometimes get pushback, but we're like, hey, if we were tracking erections in professional runners,
I forget. I listened to one of your episodes where you were talking about the always be building base, where you're like, if somebody could do 40 hours of base building, like that'd be great if they could eat enough, but they'd probably never get a boner again. I laughed out loud because I was like, that is like that tracks with my own experience, where it's like if you're doing 30 or 40 hours of exercise a week, it's like you just do not care about having sex. You know, you're just like, I'm so tired. Like, who cares?
There's a lot of research on that, actually. I do some research, and like a common question that I ask in questionnaires is about morning erections. So I say morning erections in research and boners on the SWAT podcast. It's the terminology that we use.
See, in Strava, we track weekly miles. We should really be tracking weekly boners. Like, see,
if you're getting morning boners, that means your training's all on the right track then? Are you saying you're not overtaxing?
Very healthy.
Yeah, okay, perfect,
training.
Perfect.
Yeah. And then it's complicated because like, you know, it's a tough conversation to have, and everyone's so different from baseline.
you feel weird asking your clients how their erections are doing?
Not a tough conversation to have.
It's not a tough conversation to ask your male athletes that you coach about their erections?
No, I'm a doctor.
Okay.
Yeah. I frame it like that.
Okay. Well, I'm a lawyer and I don't have that swag. But you know, I mean, it's one of the coolest things about training theory is how, like, if you actually look at the downstream impacts, you get so much more data than the numbers that you see on paper in general. And so, like, the way we coach is we try to check in with every athlete every day year round as much as we possibly can, not for the running numbers, but to kind of track these things about how they feel. Because, like, yeah, we're joking around a little bit about erections, even though we're kind of being serious, but also just manifesting, like, the amount you want to wake up at midnight to change a kid's diaper or whatever. And you know, for someone like you, the only way you're going to improve at this point is to be, like, at these astronomical levels of performance. And so, you know, if you're undercutting your body in any way, whether it's fueling or something else, that's probably not going to be, like, beneficial for that, like, adapting to whatever the next level is for you, which, you know, I can't wait to see.
Yeah, well, we'll see. The last year or so, I'm like, oh, the bummer of doing a lot of things that you want to do is that then it means to do new things is just so freaking hard.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like doing the Red Rock Traverse, like the big mountain traverse thing I just did, yeah. It's like, I don't know. I mean, I remember, you know, 5-10 years ago, soloing one of those routes felt like a big, like, oh, that's so cool. I went and, like, climbed this mountain. Or I think I did, I don't know, something like 8 sort of mountains that are in a row. And I mean, a bunch more named summits and whatever, but it's kind of like, I'd have to count, but it's like 6 or 8, like, big mountains. And it used to be like doing one of those up and over would be like a big outing for the day. And you'd be like pretty proud of yourself. Like, that's a big day. And now you're like, fuck, do I have to do all of them? You're like, that sucks. You know, it's like, I mean, I presume it's kind of the same for ultra runners where it's like, oh, if you win enough at a certain distance, then you're like, oh, I guess I have to do a bigger distance or something. And then you're like, oh man, like, that's a whole new can of worms.
Number of times I've woken up in a hotel room and be like, what the fuck? Like, why am I doing this and not something quite shorter?
Actually, we do push back though. We're on a short distance mission in trail running, is to keep the short distance races going.
That's kind of our goal, is to, like, make it so that an hour event is just as meaningful, but
just as sexy. It's important. Yeah.
Hey, actually, can I ask one more random training question? Like, so for whatever reason, I've kind of always had in the back of my mind the life goal to run a sub 3-hour marathon. Never tried. Can't run on a road, like, at all. Actually, no, I have. I heard you guys talking about the CIM. I ran the CIM in like 2009 because I'm from Sacramento. Yeah. So my mom had run a marathon. She's like old and ran really slow. But I was like, oh, if she can do it, I should try it. And so I just signed up for CIM. And I ran it having never run more than like maybe 8 miles on trail, you know, just kind of like rest day runs. And so I got completely obliterated. Like, I was like, my legs were destroyed. But I ran a 3:35 or something, I think, with like no... like, I'd say I'm much more fit for that kind of thing now. But I'm like, what would it take to run a sub? I feel like running sub 3 hours is like starting to be like real running, where you're like actually running the whole time.
Your 50K,
like, kind of briskly.
Your 50K is basically equivalent to that with just like a few more specific, a little bit more specific work. Like, obviously.
Oh, but I think if I tried to run a sub 3-hour marathon right now, I think I would die. Like, I think my legs would like blow up like a train being
I think you definitely do it long term. I think 4 days of training a week and you can run a sub 3-hour marathon.
I mean, the only problem right now for you, like, you're, all the fitness is there from the 50K. Like, that is basically the equivalent of a sub 3 marathon, or approximately, is that, like, biomechanically, 6:53 pace or whatever will probably feel like sprinting for you.
Totally.
The climbing ceiling, once you raise that, these pitches that you're describing that would kill me feel like, you know, walk in the park, you can do in the dark and not even in tennis shoes or whatever.
That's actually true. Yeah, I am literally doing it in the dark in tennis shoes.
Exactly. And so once you raise the ceiling on your running slightly, that fitness that you already have will express itself at just a slightly faster pace. So,
how do you raise the ceiling?
Well, so that's where strides come in. That's why we
like
mentioned
speed work and stuff.
That's the dreaded 12x1 minute. That's where that comes in.
But not even speed work. I mean, honestly, those 4x20 seconds things we talked about, essentially all that means in a really simplified way is by raising the ceiling, you raise the floor. And it makes it so that all the fitness you've already developed, like, those aren't really developing, like, quote unquote fitness, at least aerobically. But it makes it so that the output per stride, that the same amount of, like, glycogen use approximates, ends up being higher. So when I said running economy gets better, essentially all that means is you use less energy to go faster paces. So for someone like you, you're already there. It just literally requires, like, making it so that, you know, you could run 6-minute pace without wanting to, like, die.
If we put numbers on it, I feel like if you did strides 2 days a week and did one long run with some structure in it, like some surges or some 1-minute efforts, I think you could run
for 4 weeks.
For 4 weeks. Actually, I think 6 weeks just to be... by me. Actually, he's got a big base. 4 weeks is good.
Yeah, I was about to say, this is Alex Honnold, Megan. What are you talking about?
Are you wearing super shoes? Could you wear super shoes? Is that against the Alex Honnold philosophy?
No, no, I wear, I don't know, La Sportiva. I'm sponsored by Sportiva, so I just wear whatever they send me.
Love okay, well, yeah. We're going to make La Sportiva. We're going to get some Nikes and just for road running, not for everything else. La Sportiva is the best trail shoes. And then we're going to get some of the Nike road shoes with those big old thing, like 45 millimeter soles that we're going to write.
Wait, is that a thing?
Oh, well, they're like, I mean, 40.
They're thick. Yeah, they're real thick.
That's why everyone's going so fast nowadays is they have these shoes. And I got to be honest, I've worn them too, just so I can create some Strava porn, some workout files that are really cool, that have springs in them. You know, just
the, are they like insane?
Oh, they're insane. I mean, they're guaranteed 4%.
But also, the reason you'll like it is that, in particular, is that they're soft and they spare your body. So, what you're describing, that marathon feeling, you get it much less now when you run in those shoes, and they wear down real fast, so you can't wear them too much. But like if I wear them in a workout, I'm not like, I don't feel it the next day. And similarly for you, you know, this kind of changes.
But isn't the point of the workout though, to feel it the next day to some extent? I mean, aren't you?
Alex, you're giving me really good coaching advice here that Megan has told me many times as my coach. That's why. Yeah, no, for sure. And the one complicating factor is that it encourages a slightly different power generation because of the carbon plate. So it encourages slightly more power being put into the stride rather than cadence for a lot of runners. So if you're going to be racing in it, it helps to run in it. Granted, I'm not racing in it. I just like the way it feels.
Well, your exact question actually is why I tell David, I give David a two day per week limit on wearing super shoes, because it does. It actually, like, I think it's better in terms of foot engagement, in terms of like stride engagement, not to overuse them. So we do have limitations on how many days per week.
But yeah, so I think CIM, maybe that's like a 40, age 40 goal for you.
We'll pace you.
Actually, it's a good, Will you carry the sign? Because I know that's a big
thing. Oh, yeah. Oh, I will carry. I mean, if I'm running with you, I'll carry a freak flag, actually. Yeah, that's what I'll carry, a full-scale freak flag.
Actually, hearing you guys talk about that and whatever the last podcast, I was like, I remember running CIM, and I remember seeing the guys like carrying the big signpost with the number and stuff. And I was like, it's so fucking weird. Well, whatever. Yeah, I was psyched. But actually, that's a good goal. I think 40 at CIM, I'm going to go sub 3.
That's, let's do it. Oh, you can definitely do it. Yeah.
And we're going to like,
we're going to send you some super shoes.
We're going to create a flying V around you just to have the draft going.
No, that I would feel bad about. I think the super shoes and the flying V is too, like, I want it to be like, oh, I just went and I ran. I felt normal. It was like, you know, I want it, same with running an ultra, is like, I just want it to feel like this is a normal day, but I can just like do something that I couldn't do before. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, because I think if I was doing all the crazy technique and like strategy stuff like that, I'd be trying to run a sub 2 hour marathon. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that stuff is only justified if you're truly elite, but it's like running a sub 3 hour marathon, like, who cares? You know what I mean? It's like only I would be proud of that. And so I want to do it like in a totally normal, like casual way.
Well, we would be very proud of it. Actually, before recording this podcast, David had a serious conversation with me. He was like, please do not tell Alex how much you love him. Like again and again and again. He was like, he's not going to like that, but we would be your biggest fans if you did that. We'd be so proud of you.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, to end the podcast, just because I want to talk to you all day, but I can't do that to you, is, you know, you did this running thing. And to me, it's the coolest shit because, you know, in multiple, all these, this running stuff, because like, if I did that, I would be so self-conscious about it. Like, and the fact that you didn't, I think is probably one of the most inspirational things you've ever done for a lot of people that follow you. Like, because essentially it just means, hey, you put yourself out there, you have fun, get a little vulnerable, talk to people, eat some snacks. And that's what life's about, is just to be there and do the thing you want to do. And so, yeah. Hell yeah.
And get really, really, really sore. So I'm very impressed.
that's everything I want in life. Free snacks, nice folks, getting super sore. I'm like, that's what I aspire to, you know, having a good time in the mountains.
Alex, we love you so much. This is an honor, and we can't wait to be your biggest fans forever in the future. And Megan will say she loves you 8 times, and she actually gets a morning erection from thinking about Alex Honnold, or the female equivalent of that. So
I was like, whoa, man.
Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. And actually, just so I remember, so my takeaways are that I should run more often than I think for shorter times. Mm-hmm. I should incorporate strides. And then I basically won't worry about any of the other stuff until I'm like a month or two out from wanting to run an ultra. And then I'll start to think about actually running for real.
Yeah, exactly. That's how base building works in running, essentially, is that, you know, occasionally you can run faster on some of the uphills in general too, like for a few minutes at a time where you just work a little bit higher zones with a higher heart rate. But other than that, just keep it easy. All of your work that you're doing otherwise will fit in. And then just those strides will make it so that running fast doesn't feel like death. And you combine all that, and it's like, the cool thing about what you've already done is like all the fitness is there, and it'll get way easier, and then it'll get more fun. And so that's the coolest part. Probably like a lot like if you climb every day, eventually climbing just gets nicer. If you run.
Yeah, totally.
I can almost guarantee if you do 4 days of strides, you're going to feel really good. I can almost guarantee that.
Across a few weeks.
I don't know. I feel like he's such a good athlete that he does 4 stride sessions. His running economy will start getting better.
The studies back it up.
Yeah.
Well, I'll let you know how it goes.
All right, Alex, we can't wait for your future. Thank you for being on the podcast. And also thank you for the Honnold Foundation. We're going to be talking about that in the intro to this. Yeah, can't wait to see what you do from here.
Cool. No, my pleasure. My pleasure. I'll keep listening. So I'll probably skip this episode because it makes me very self-conscious. But in general, it's a pleasure listening to you guys, and you know, all the best.
You're the absolute best. Seriously, thank you so much.
In conclusion, morning erections.
Huzzah.
Huzzah. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
You rock, Alex.